Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
That's a surprise. That's not really what you expected at all, is it?
Why?
I'm sure they tuned in to listen to us, and here we are again.
Here we are again. They might have accidentally found us.
There you go.
Well, today we're drinking, aren't we?
Well, if you accidentally found us, welcome to the program. We hope you'll become a regular listener because we think we have fun, and today we are drinking.
Yes.
Indeed we are.
And starting off with, you know, what a coup. I've been dying to interview Dale DeGroff for ages now, and here we have him.
We're talking to master mixologist Dale DeGroff, who is also known as King Cocktail. Hello, Dale.
Hi, Ann.
I've wanted to talk to you for such a long time. Your life seems so interesting. You're right on trend for all your information about cocktails. You've written a wonderful book, which is called?
It's called The Essential Cocktail. It's actually my second book. The first was called The Craft of the Cocktail.
Okay, that's right. Tell us how you got where you are.
Part accident, part luck. I came to New York in the late 60s, early 70s, and it was a good time to be here. Kind of caught the end of an era and the beginning of a new era. I had a friend whose older brother owned an ad agency called Lois Holland and Calloway, and they were significant because they did the advertising for Restaurant Associates, and at that time the president was Joseph Baum.
And who's legendary.
In history, they probably don't know Joe.
Oh, he's legendary. I mean,
yeah. But Joe was, in my opinion, a genius, and I had the really good fortune to spend those early days. I got to meet Joe through the agency and through my best friend's older brother. I was at table with Joe, and I didn't have a lot of money, but because we were part of the family, kind of, we got to go to the Four Seasons, La Fonda del Sol, former of the 12 Caesars, and I got to see this stuff firsthand and taste the food and see Joe's style and what he was all about. And in my opinion, when Joe opened La Fonda del Sol and the Four Seasons in the same year, 1959, it really changed the way we eat in America.
So at this point, you were into food.
At that point, I was into food because I was poor and I had a chance to get a free meal.
There we go.
I was trying to be an actor, to tell you the truth, Ann.
Oh, that's funny.
And I ended up, of course, as a dishwasher, then a bartender, then a waiter, and then a bartender. And that's when you say, oh, I'm going to take my acting seriously. I think I'll get a bartending job.
Well, but, are you still calling yourself a bartender? Or are you now a mixologist, or are
you
a bar chef?
The whole idea of the mixologist in the Rainbow Room days, when I finally did go to work for Joe in 1985 in earnest as the head bartender first at Aurora. You may have been to Aurora, that fine dining restaurant that he did on the east side of Manhattan, but I had 2 years there to figure out what it was that Joe wanted, because when he hired me, he said, Dale, I want a classic 19th century bar. I don't want any mixes. I don't want any soda guns. I want classic recipes. I want real ingredients. And, you know, I had been trained like most bartenders had, sort of on the fly, because there were no great schools or academies like there were on the culinary side of the business. And we were using sweet and sour and guns, and so it took me really 2 years to figure out what it was that Joe wanted. And thank God I had those 2 years, because that whole time Joe was working on the restoration of the Rainbow Room on top of the GE, formerly RCA building. And I wanted in on that. And this opportunity, this two-year opportunity to sort of hone my craft of 19th century actual classic bartending gave me the opportunity to create a menu for Joe for the Rainbow Room and then eventually take over as the head bartender there.
What a wonderful concept that turned out to be, huh?
It's sad what happened now. I mean, we lost our lease in 99, but in those intervening 12 years, it was just an exceptionally creative and interesting place to be. And that whole classic cocktail thing, I believe that we had a lot to do because we were such high profile, as everybody who was associated with Joe was. We had a lot to do, I think, with bringing that style, that culinary style of cocktail back into being. And
yeah, but you're credited with the pioneering the gourmet approach to the classic cocktail.
Yeah, essentially going back to real ingredients. I mean, it's sort of what happened coincidentally the 20 years prior on the food side of the business when everybody was, I mean, when I went to Manhattan in 1969, if you went to a four-star restaurant, the guy was going to be French or he was going to be Italian. He was not going to be American.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the way it was in those days. And that all changed. I mean, I watched it change. It happened around me. I mean, Larry Forgione, Alice Waters, Waldy Maluth, all these guys, all these Americans who started rising to the top, the extraordinary. I mean, look at Tim Zagat, for example. When Tim came out with his 1979 edition, I think he had like six or seven ethnic cuisines listed in the back of the guide. And today he lists like 98 or 100
classifications
and varieties in the back of that guide. And that's just volumes of what's happened, I think.
Well, you've won so many awards, James Beard, for the Professional Wine and Spirits Award, a Lifetime Achievement Award from Nightclub and Bar Magazine. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. So it's not just like inside the family. I think that everybody now is looking to the cocktail with the same kind of respect that they were looking to, at one time Baked Alaska, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny, Baked Alaska at the Rainbow Room was one of the places where I stole a couple of tricks from the chef.
Well,
I used his berry mix in the cocktail.
Yeah, well, see, I actually did an article on the cocktail, the new cocktail, and interviewed a whole bunch of people, and a lot of them are mixing up with the kitchen. I mean, grabbing their supplies and
yeah, I would go into the freezer and get those wonderful purees from Robbie Fruit, and the chef would come screaming to me at the bar, "Where's my passion fruit?" it was great times, and I worked through several different chefs there, and that's where we started doing the cocktail dinners just for the fun of it. I think I did the first one maybe with Wally Maloof. I'm not sure. Where we would match a five-course meal with five different cocktails. It was just great fun.
Yeah, now, well, we've had some of that, actually. Some cocktails. Where was that, Rabbit? We had some kind of a cocktail with a tasting menu.
Well, if you did Tales of the Cocktail in New Orleans, you probably did it down there, because that's one of the segments of Tales of the Cocktail, cocktail dinners at the famous New Orleans restaurants like Galatoire's, Arnaud's, Upper Line, et cetera, et cetera.
Don't you love the woman at Upper Line? What's her name, Rabbit?
Joanna. Yeah.
Joanna
Clevenger, I think.
Clevenger.
Yeah, she's got a history. Boy, she used to run saloons in the French Quarter. She's quite a woman.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
So, and you're very active in New Orleans with the Museum of the American Cocktail.
Well, we got sort of hijacked by Katrina, and we had to start all over again, and we've just got it reopened for about a year now, and we're raising funds to try to expand our exhibit, and we're happy to be in New Orleans because it's such a center of history. It's such an unusual American city, and I think it's a great place for this kind of a museum to have its home.
Yeah.
Now, we had, when we were in New Orleans, I discovered a liking for a very old cocktail. In fact, some people say the very first one, which is a Sazerac.
Oh my God! It is. Along with the old-fashioned, probably right there at the beginning of the whole idea of the cocktail.
Now, when you were doing this with Joe at the Rainbow Room, were you doing those kinds of traditional cocktails?
Absolutely.
Like Manhattans?
Absolutely.
So that was your forte.
Set it apart. I had things on my menu that hadn't seen the light of day, some since the 19th century, some since just before Prohibition. So I had Between the Sheets, I had Ramos Fizz, I had Sazeracs, I had Pisco Sours. Well, actually, I have to say that I borrowed the Pisco Sour from Joe's La Fonda del Sol menu from 1959. Joe was so far ahead of his time, it's just mind-boggling. But he had so much to do with every aspect of the business, because it was Joe who mentored Kevin Zraley, who went on to mentor so many young sommeliers. It was Joe who had the idea that we should make wine accessible, take the snobbery out of the sale of it, sell it at a lower price point. And it was Joe who came to me right before Aurora and said, "I want a classic bar." And he just had such an impact on the industry through his people. And Joe would never tell you what to do. He would tell you what he wanted.
Yeah.
And then you had to figure it out. I remember complaining to Joe right at the beginning of Aurora and saying, "Joe, don't you think we should have some of that sour mix around in case we get really busy and I can't keep up with the fresh?" And Joe stopped me. And he said, "Look, Dale, there were some pretty big bars in the 19th century that were just packed to the gills, and that's all they used is fresh juices. And if you can't figure out how to do this, I'll find somebody who can." Oh, no, I got it, don't worry.
Well, now,
I didn't quite have it. It took me a couple of years to get it, but I got it.
Now, some new things are happening now, though. Now we have cocktails that have sticks and twigs and flowers and fresh fruit.
Not to mention bacon.
I mean, what do you think of? Are you a part of that trend, or what do you think
about
it?
I have been a champion of it, and will be a part of it, and love to see the directions. I'm not saying that these things are going to be impact the mainstream in a large way, but they are. Like on the culinary side, there was a lot of stuff that happened in the beginning. We all know Nouvelle Cuisine and things that seemed kind of awkward and silly, but they all led us to a final destination where we are today, and that is a love affair with big flavor, huge choices for the diner in terms of variety and classifications of food. So I see this as a growth period for the Cockfield, just the way we had that same growth period on the culinary side of the business. And some of it's kind of silly, some of it's fun, some of it's creative, and it's what's good will last and what's not will just...
And it's like molecular gastronomy, except it's molecular mixology.
Exactly. It's fun. It's fun, and it makes people think about their ingredients, and that's good.
That's important.
Now, we've interviewed Scott Beattie on the program, in fact, a couple of times, and Eben Freeman in New York is an old friend as well.
I know Eben.
Who are some of the other guys who you think are really on
the... Well, overseas, you have Tony Conigliaro in London, who's sort of, he's studied with Hester Blumenthal, and he's been on the ground floor with all that stuff.
Yeah.
You have Salvatore Calabresi at 50, who's a classic bartender.
Who's the guy in Las Vegas that's...
Tony Abuganen.
Yeah,
in
that
Las
one.
Vegas, who's just... He actually... I really credit Tony with turning that town around. The cocktail was an amenity for the tables, and he really made it good again and made it great again. I mean, he was serving fresh fruit, lemon and lime juice, Collins's and sour-style cocktails at the Bellagio at the bars where 25,000 drinks a day were going out through those bars, and he figured
good
out a way
grief.
To do it.
25,000?
25,000 drinks a day. So whenever
shoot.
I go into a young fella in a bartender who's got an operation and tells me that he'd like to go fresh, but he's just too busy.
Right.
You know, I say, well, do you do 25,000 drinks a day? Because Tony did it.
Now, looking, as expert as you are, what does your crystal ball say about what's just around the corner and what's even further down the road for the cocktail?
Well, I tell you one thing, setting the cocktail itself aside for just a moment. You mentioned the James Beard Award. Well, I think this year I won the James Beard Award, and I don't think a bartender has ever won the James Beard Award. And that has got to say something to young bartenders all across the country.
Oh, that's
that
good.
This is indeed a profession that they can be proud of, that they can prosper in, that has deep roots in our history, that got damaged by Prohibition, but it's back, and there's nothing to be ashamed of. There is great future, whether you want to be on the corporate food side or on the independent restaurant side, there is a great future now because this is a growing thing. It's not going to turn back. It's only going to go forward. It's more and more complex every year. You have to learn about wine, about sake, about shochu, about beer and how it's made, about all these new products that are coming on the market. So it's intense and complex, and I think that is really the future. Because we see this, you and I are dealing on a very high level in the culinary world, and so we see all the cutting-edge stuff. But 95% of the bartenders who are hired in America are hired by Darden or Hilton or Marriott. And those are the guys we got to get to.
Uh-huh.
Those are the people that are serving America. And if we're going to increase the quality the way they have done on the food side in these sort of mid-range, multi-unit restaurant type places, because a lot of them are turning out really good food. They're getting Reggiano Parmesan from Italy. They're getting real olive oil. We can do this on the beverage side as well.
You know, they did something. Capital Grille has a signature cocktail that's all fresh stuff.
This is good. These are the people that I want to reach.
And Morton's commissioned the guy in Vegas you mentioned.
Yes, he did. Yes, they did.
That's
great. And I worked with the Marriott to create their new bar arts program, and they're requiring all of their franchisees to go fresh over the next couple of years, which is a real significant breakthrough.
Is there any kind of certification like there is with wine? With
well,
sommeliers?
I'm a partner in Beverage Alcohol Resource.
Bar.
Siebel. Yeah. Steve Olson, Doug Frost, a name you might know on the wine side. David Wondrich, the Esquire Drinks editor.
Oh, I know him. Yeah.
Paul Packle, the Kindred Spirits and author of several books. Myself, Andy Seymour, and they're all educators, and they're all at the top of their industry, and we have a 5-day bartender boot camp certification course here in New York City that now I think something in the neighborhood of 500 guys have gone through. We also have, beyond that, a master's program, which takes a year. It's like getting a master's thesis in graduate school where they actually take a project and have to see it through to the end. And we just started this over the last 4 or 5 years, and we're hoping that it will become a significant part. We've partnered with a large drinks company called Pernod Ricard to do a larger version of this to reach more bartenders called Bar Smarts, And I'm hoping this will be the future of education for bartenders in America.
I think this is so exciting, Dale.
It's good stuff. It's really good stuff.
Now, if you were drinking on your own, what is your spirit of choice?
Well, that's really, really tough because I'm a gin martini drinker. I love it, but I love a good daiquiri because it's so hard to find a good daiquiri today. I love a Sazerac, the one you brought up before.
Peter loves Sazerac,
too. It's well made. I mean, now we're coming up on rum day here on Sunday.
Yeah, and I was saying, well, we better say something about rum.
Rum is such a great story because it's so intertwined with the history of the United States. I mean, if you think about rum back in colonial times, rum is one of the reasons why we're a country today. And I know that sounds crazy.
Instead of tea, it's rum.
It's absolutely true because there were like 40 rum distilleries between Providence, Rhode Island, and Boston, Massachusetts. And those distilleries were a huge thriving business for colonial America, and it was making the English very unhappy, and that's why they passed the Molasses Act, the Sugar Act, the Stamp Act, the Improved Molasses Act, and those are the things that led to the Continental Army and the Continental Congress, and that's why we fought these guys, because they wanted to control our industries, and rum was our main industry at the time.
Wow.
Well, there was, of course, a famous whiskey rebellion right around
Alexander Hamilton tried to tax the poor guys who just won the war for them. the rum and whiskey makers.
The funny part about it is at the same time as all this was going on, rum was what kept the Royal Navy going and made it the best fighting force in the world.
You can see why they want to control the industry, right?
Right.
And, rum started down in the Caribbean. Christopher Columbus brought over on his second voyage sugarcane. It just did extraordinarily well. Probably Barbados, this Mr. Gay, the Englishman, his brand known today as Mount Gay, he probably started the ball rolling around 1637 through 1700 down there. And the Portuguese were doing rum in Brazil coincidentally with that. So it really got in. It was the first New World spirit. I mean, it really was. Of course, later corn whiskey became synonymous with an American heritage product, but it was rum that had that significant impact on our history. And I'm really glad that the Mount Gay Company chose Sunday as National Rum Day, because Sunday is the day when we can all be in our backyards and not have to get behind the wheel of an automobile.
Cool transition, Dale. Very cool transition.
So is there something special we'll be making tomorrow? Is there a special cocktail?
Oh, there are. There's such good rum cocktails. This thing that they've the Pride of Barbados that they sent around, I don't know if they sent you a copy of it, it's kind of a look back to Don the Beachcomber, who was one of the genius bartenders of rum.
Oh, yeah, I remember Don the Beachcomber.
And look, rum, unlike any other spirit, likes to be mixed with itself. And it's not unusual to find three rums in a rum drink. And then this one is no exception. It's got the Mount Gay Extra Old mixed with the Mount Gay Eclipse, which is, by the way, named after the eclipse of 1910. It happened on the same year that
there's so much history in all this, and you know all of it. You'd be somebody I'd like to go out and hang with and have a drink with.
And if they mix this with fresh grapefruit juice, fresh lime juice. Now, here's the key. Allspice or cinnamon syrup. And these are two things you can make so simply in the kitchen. Two cups of sugar, one cup of water, 24 allspice berries, or about 15 or 20 cinnamons. Simmer it for about an hour and a half, 2 hours. Strain out the solids, and you've got a spicy, wonderful, simple syrup that you could add into the grapefruit juice, lime juice, and Angostura bitters to make an extraordinarily good drink called the Pride of Barbados.
Well, here's what we got to do. We're going to have to stop this conversation because I'm going to have to go off to the state liquor store and buy three kinds of rum. Otherwise, we won't be able to have this on Sunday. But, Dale, thank you so much for joining us. It was a pleasure to hear about your fascinating life story and all your knowledge of the wonderful world of cocktails. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure to be with you, Peter and Ann. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Oh, yeah, and any time, please. Rejoin us whenever you have something new to talk about.
You take care now. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Dale. Bye-bye.
So you may not know everything there is to know about mixology or the art of the cocktail or whatever you like, certainly you know a lot more than you did before
you
started.
Yeah, but I have a question.
You have a question, okay? Go ahead.
I mean, do they spit when they're tasting cocktails? I mean, like they do with wine? It seems kind of unsophisticated to do that.
I think bartenders tend to keep a pale beverage behind the counter, so that it can be whatever they want. But in general, I think they just drink soda water.
No, I meant if you're doing a cocktail tasting.
I I don't know. I guess we'll have to get another mixologist on and we'll ask, because we forgot to ask Dale that.
Right.
Well, I mean, I'm sure if they're testing, they must taste. Whether they then share with their friends or whether they spit, I don't know. That's a good question. I guess next time we have a mixologist on the air, we'll have to ask him what the story is.
Okay, and now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Please do continue to communicate with us through various networks, including what?
Facebook, Twitter. You can follow our blog.
Plaxo.
Yeah,
we're
on Plaxo too? I didn't know we were on that one.
Yes.
Oh my goodness. We're everywhere. But I don't know how you get on Plaxo from our homepage. I know that if you want to email or Twitter or Facebook, all you need to do is click the icon on our homepage and you'll be connected, and we'll love to hear from you. And we're staying on theme.
Oh, yeah, my new best friends, the Harneys.
New best friends. Well, they really are characters, and they certainly have grown in the tea business. And, let's just listen to the story.
We have a father-son duo on the line here now. John, one of my favorite people, and I'm just meeting Michael, and they are both from Harney Teas, which I can attest is a very fine tea company. I guess, John, you founded the company, so why don't you tell us exactly how you ended up in teas? I know for a while your first job was in Pittsburgh, and you were a graduate of Cornell's hotel school.
That's right.
And you did some restaurant management. So how did you move from all that into teas?
Well, I actually just fell into it. And the reason I fell into it was when I started the White Hart Inn in Salisbury, which is an old historic inn, I had the great pleasure of meeting a man by the name of Stanley Mason, who lived in the town of Salisbury, Connecticut, on it, and he asked me if I would serve his tea.
Mason and Fortnum, no?
Oh, yeah. Mason had a little tea company. On it, and
not Fortnum and Mason.
So. No. No, I wish he was, and I'm sure he wished he was.
Yeah, that's it.
His brother was president of Brook Bond at one time, though.
Uh-huh.
But he didn't make it on that. He had been transferred in 1927 to come to the United States and to popularize tea drinking here more than it was. And so he did on it and found an American lady, married her. And he continued to push tea in America until 1955, when he retired. And when he retired, he started a little tiny company out of his living room up at Taconic, Connecticut, which is inside Salisbury. He did that, and he came to me in 1960 and asked me to serve his tea, as I said. On it, and we did on it, and every day somebody would ask me where to buy the tea, and we were doing it with tea bags. In 1967, he came back to me, and he said, it's time to move to loose-leaf tea.
Ah.
And I didn't know what loose-leaf tea was, frankly, on it, and we switched over.
Wasn't that early for doing that?
Yeah, that was very early for doing this, but he wanted to do it, and I only bought when I had to try to figure out whether I was going to buy silver strainers on it, because I didn't want to buy silver strainers, and we didn't serve it with strainers. And we did that from 1967 until 1983, when we sold the inn.
Now,
some people would complain, maybe once or twice a month, would complain that they had some leaves in the bottom of the cup. And I would say, wait one moment. Didn't you have salad? I thought I saw you having salad. They said, yes. And I said, what did you think you had? You had lettuce leaves, and now you also had tea leaves. And so they're about the same. Anyhow, we got through that little thing. But every day,
somebody, one, two, three, five people, depending on how many people drank tea, would come to me and ask me where to go and get tea. I'm still not that impressed, but nobody ever asked me where I got any on it. So I thought it was a joy having that happen. So anyhow, that's how we got started on it, and I got my interest in tea. It started building up. In 1970, he came to me, tried to buy House of Herbs. You remember House of Herbs?
No.
That and Spice Isle were your two great herbs.
Spice Isle, I remember.
Yeah, you remember Spice Isle.
Yeah.
They were both very good herb companies. And we tried to buy House of Herbs on it, but we didn't get it. He heard about it, Stanley Mason heard about it, and asked me, why don't you buy my company? I'm 70 years old, and I want to get out for a while. And so I said, fine, we'll do it.
That was when 70 was considered old. My father turned 79 tomorrow, or next week or so. He is a young man.
He came and he worked with our company, our new company, for almost 8 or 9 years, and then he got sick and he died in 1980.
But there was an awful lot to learn.
It was a great time for me, because we moved it to the inn, the basement of the inn, the White Hart Inn, and sure enough, we started going. And every time we had waitresses standing around, we'd send them down, and they'd go pack tea. So we were selling it, and he was going out on the road selling it, but not really seriously. I mean, the whole thing was more of an education for me. And I didn't realize it at the time. 1983, we sold the inn, pulled the tea company out, and then I decided that I was the managing partner for the inn, and I didn't really want to, and there wasn't enough profit in it to have four partners come out of that thing very well. So I said, fellows, I'm out. I'm going to go do my thing. You can do your thing. And so they kept Sarum Tea, and it was called Sarum Tea. Sarum is the Roman name, the old Roman name for the town of Salisbury in England.
Oh.
And that was the year and place of his birth, and he was living in Salisbury, Connecticut.
The funny thing is, guys, I've been trying to get a word in edgeways here, but that's difficult because you're such a great raconteur. But it's really funny. You should talk about tea bags and having to invent loose tea, as though Americans invented the idea of having tea that's loose.
You're right.
I mean, they've been doing it in old serum for centuries and centuries. Now, I have to admit, though, however, that the tea that we used to get that way really didn't taste very good.
No, it didn't. And you know why it didn't? When we used to get it, going back, I mean, people drank tea in the 20s and the teens and before. The English and the people who drank tea, the French, Germans drank tea.
Well, the Americans drank quite a lot of tea. Jewel Tea Company, there's lots of great companies, Atlantic Pacific Tea Company, otherwise known as A&P.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a long tradition in the States of making and selling tea.
Hey, we had the Boston Tea Party.
That was a great tea party, probably our most famous one.
I remember writing a piece about that, saying Americans must know a lot about tea since they think it should be made with cold, salty water.
I think it might taste better another way.
I think you're right. So anyway, this business got off the ground, but it's if we fast forward to 2009 when we met you and your son at the Fancy Food Show, tea business.
Right, let me tell you how that happened.
Go ahead.
The way it happened was simply that in 1983 when we sold the inn, and I started my own company. Both Michael and another son invested in it. Michael was running a hotel out in Chicago at the time, and my other son was working for a teacher's retirement. And they had some money, so they put it in the pot. And that's how we got going, and I started packing tea in my basement in my house. And right away we picked up the Ritz-Carlton, because I knew people up at the Ritz-Carlton in Boston. And because remember, this is 1983. Ritz-Carlton Company hadn't really started yet. That was just in the process. Mr. Johnson just purchased the Ritz-Carlton in Boston to get the name on it. And he was the international president of and owner of the International Pancake Company down in the South. And that's why it ended up down in Atlanta.
It sounds like there's a ghost on your premises.
That sounded like a ghost. Another son just walked in.
Oh, I see. So this
Paul. That's Paul.
So hi, this Paul.
We started with that was one big account, and another one was a pump room in Chicago. Being operated by Richard Melman, and that's how we got to know Mr. Melman.
Let us entertain you.
We ended up doing a lot of his places on it. And what was the other one? Oh, the Great Writers Club down in New York, the Century Association. And so we had three big important ones.
But how did you know what kind of tea to get, and how did you get it? It's very sophisticated.
It is very sophisticated, and Mr. Mason took me to New York, introduced me to the people I had to know. He also took me in and showed me how to do these things. We went down, as I said, in the basement, and so I was spending some time down in the basement packing some tea. We only had a dozen kinds of tea at the time. Now we have, gosh, anywhere from 250 to 275 in numbers of teas. And the world has changed on tea. And also what the people are drinking has changed dramatically over what it was.
That was very sophisticated, the current market, isn't it?
It's much more sophisticated than it ever was, frankly.
So anyway, Michael and Paul, is it Paul? They decided that they'd better join the fun, huh?
Yeah. Michael wanted to come back to... his kids be able to live the life his kids that he lived, and with his children.
I want to have a loving father like I want to be a loving father like my father.
What a laugh that is!
That's a secret between you two. I don't want to know.
Right. No. We were fine.
But this got to be a real fancy enterprise now, didn't it?
Well, then Paul came home from the Marines and. He was a captain in the Marine Corps, and he decided he wanted to come up, and so that's how he ended here.
Now, Michael, you've made this into a real study now with a book packaged with all kinds of tea. Tell us a little bit about that, because it seems like a really good way to get to know tea if you don't.
Well, my father's father was a scientist and has PhDs and all that sort of stuff, so I tried to, it did skip a generation, but, I thought maybe we could apply a little bit of analysis to the tea world. So the idea with the book was we wanted to teas tasted good. And there was an old German guy, not as old as Stanley Mason, but an old gentleman. And he had always told me when we buy teas, you buy teas that make you smile.
Oh.
So then you go, why do they make you smile? And why does the plant make those sort of stuff that make you smile? So that's when why is tea, what different tastes, good tastes you find in tea, how do they occur, and what is, how does the plant, why does the plant make them there? Sort of like Michael Pollan, from a plant's eye view type thing.
Uh-huh.
Botany of Desire, I don't know if you've read that book or not. But the idea was to sort of look into the whole concept of tea. Say, take the English breakfast teas, why do they taste the way they do when they're made? For instance, Peter, you're from somewhere in the British Commonwealth, right?
I am, yes. And I never drink tea because I grew up disliking the taste, partly because it wasn't very good tea and partly because everybody insisted on putting milk in it anyway.
That's the whole concept, why do the British put milk in the tea? It's one of those things I tried to evaluate. And then turns out now it's sort of a chicken and egg thing because the teas don't taste good without milk and sugar, but originally they didn't put milk and sugar in, but they sort of happened at the same time many, many centuries ago.
There was this huge difference of opinion between whether you put the milk in first. They were called the MIFs.
And then the people
who put the milk in last, and I guess they were called Mills, I'm not sure.
I think originally the reason for it was that the bone china had just came out, had just started getting popular, and when they were putting the very hot water in the cup, they were cracking a lot of it.
Oh, geez.
Okay,
so
the easy way to stop it and also help the dairy industry was was put a little bit of milk in first. It cooled off the tea and got rid of some milk.
Yeah, that's fine.
The funny part about it is that there are still there are people who do it one way, and there are people who do it the other way, and they don't change. Mm-hmm. But I guess that's an English way of doing things. Whereas the Harney Tea Company, being an American enterprise, is always enterprising and always ready to change and embrace new things.
Now, you have all the great varieties of tea and a lot of blends that are attractive, such as I've been using that green tea that has coconut in it.
Isn't that a delight?
Yes. And then you have like white vanilla, grapefruit. So there are a whole bunch of things like that that you have that sort of distinguishes the company. You also have these gift packets that I just adore, like the wedding. Explain that.
Tagalongs.
Is that what they're called, tagalongs?
We officially call them because they tag along with you.
People carry them when they're traveling to make it easy to have their tea.
Oh, yeah, those, right. But you have a bridal package, too, don't you?
Oh, yeah.
And here's a mother's bouquet for Mother's Day.
Well, we can't do justice to all of these things. I think what we better do is, before we forget, we better make sure that people know how to find Harney Teas. So you probably have a website and a store locator. Why don't you give us that information?
Oh, our website is at www, that's three W's, I believe, .harney, H-A-R-N-E-Y, .com, C-O-M.
Okay, and all of your products are there, and you also distribute via the internet, right?
We sell a lot on the internet. We've been doing very well with that. We have a shop, which is 2 hours north of New York City, and people can come up and taste quite a few teas, and then have a bite to eat, and then go shopping. So it's been a lovely experience for most people.
You have great little accessories like the strainers too.
Yes.
I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, Mike, what is your best advice for learning how to sip tea?
To sip tea or to make it?
I was thinking of appreciation, but...
Appreciation, great. Well, I mean, the joy to sipping is, of course, you can relax and enjoy it. So either you put milk and sugar in or not, as you see.
It'd be a myth or a mill.
You prefer milk.
No, I don't. I take mine straight.
No,
me too.
Emma's laughing and saying you have to
milk in never, M-I-L. Which I don't have a problem with at all because I don't put it in. But in any event, when you just appreciate the tea, which of course is just drinking it. Now, with wine, there is a whole protocol to tasting teas, and those people that are trying to sort of figure out the various intricacies of tea, what we recommend is like with wine. So the idea is that you take the liquid tea, you let it cool off a little bit so you don't burn yourself, of course, and then you're going to make that liquid into a gas. So the idea is you slurp it, and then you're able to smell it retronasally, which means coming up from the backside rather than from your nose.
They do that with all of
them. Oh, I see. So it's allowed to make noise. That's not rude. That's appreciation.
Yeah. They do
we
that
learn
with
from
all
the Chinese,
of
and we know that they sometimes do things that we don't understand.
they do many things I don't understand. But then people who drink tea are people I don't understand also.
You understand me, I drink tea.
Is out straight when you're slurping, it's okay.
Okay, well, that's very good. Well, gentlemen, it was just a delight and a great amusement, and great education to have you join us on the program. And John, I'm so glad that we met you in New York. And
I'm so glad I met you guys too. I mean, let's face it. Remember, my first job out of college was Cornell, and down to Pittsburgh.
Right, and where you worked is at least 700 yards, or maybe 600 yards from where we're sitting right now. So next time I walk by, I'll be sure to say hi from John Harney to the Kenilworth, which sadly doesn't have a shop on the corner anymore. although the space is available, so if you're interested in...
thank you.
My favorite bit of information was John told me that place was, which actually was owned by somebody I went to school with, I mean his father, that it was actually a place where certain mistresses were kept.
it's true. Kenilworth apartments.
I wonder where they keep them now the drugstore is closed. But that's a story for another day. Gentlemen, thank
John
you.
John and Mike, love talking to you.
Thank you.
Stay in touch with us. We'll email you when we'll get in touch with you.
All right, that's a good idea.
Okay.
Thank you and good night.
Thank you too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And did we mention, I can't remember, about all the tools that come with that tea tasting kit? I just rediscovered that kit with the thermometer and everything.
I don't remember about the thermometer, but then...
All kinds of little tools you use for this tea tasting.
So if you want to be a tea tasting expert, the Harney Tea guys are the ones to get in touch with. But we have more exciting tea after the break. In the meantime, let's take one.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again, and we're going more global. Is that what we're doing?
Well, I think Harney Tea is global as well, but
they are too.
The Rishi Tea guys from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, of all places, is certainly a very surprising enterprise, a very interesting story, and some mighty fine teas as well. So let's hear from a spokesperson for Rishi Tea.
Susanna, I forgot to ask you if it's Mojico or Mojico.
Mojica.
Mojica. With an A?
Yes, exactly.
Oh, see, I had the wrong spelling myself. Anyhow, you're going to be talking to us today. You are in charge of the retail end of Rishi Tea, and you're going to be talking to us about the company, its products. Let's start out with who founded it, the story you were telling us, and how long ago.
Sure thing. The company was founded by Joshua Kaiser about 12 years ago. He was doing a lot of traveling after college and was traveling through Asia and realized that they had amazing loose leaf tea and an amazing culture around it. And when he would come back to the United States, he just couldn't find tea like that. He couldn't find tea that had the culture and the story that he was encountering in China. So he started importing tea himself. And he just started in small batches, started doing it in his backpack. The demand was definitely there. The business started growing. So he contacted Benjamin Harrison, who had been working in New York City at the time. And they both started out. And 12 years later, here they are together, still running the company. It's definitely a lot bigger than his backpack now.
Now, how did he get interested? I mean, Milwaukee, Wisconsin is a hotbed of beer and brats.
And we have some connoisseurs of beverages here. They actually grew up here in Milwaukee, and it's right in the middle, right between the East Coast and the West Coast, so it just seemed natural to start Rishi Tea out here since this was home for both of them and in a good location.
Is Rishi a Chinese name? It sounds Japanese.
No, it's actually Sanskrit, and it means pioneer.
Oh, interesting.
Well, how about they've certainly grown it in a big way. Now, how many thousands of teas do you have now?
Well, it does seem like thousands. We have over 150 different teas. And
Loose leaf.
Yes, they are all loose leaf tea. Mm-hmm. Most of them are organic, and a good portion are fair trade certified.
Huh. Not all, but good. You have some other interesting products, too. You had those... to go, tea to go, that was really like powder?
Oh, yeah, yeah, those are amazing. They're really gaining traction right now. They are natural pink leaf powders. There are four of them, and all it is, it's the entire leaf milled into a powder, which you can then prepare very easily by putting into a water bottle and shaking, and you have tea that's ready that's 100% antioxidants, and, yeah, it's a really cool product.
Now, this is tea that's deliberately ground.
Oh, yeah.
It is.
Not the kind of tea dust and scrapings that you get in tea bags. At least,
no.
Lisa, the manufacturers of tea bags.
This is more like a matcha, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. We do offer a matcha. And with that one, you can prepare it either hot in the traditional manner, or you can prepare it in the water bottle.
Yeah, well, I didn't share it with you, Rabbit, but I had it.
Oh, you didn't. There you go.
I did have it.
Well, what was the one I had at the fancy food show?
You like that red one.
It was crimson something or other?
Oh, that was tropical crimson. That was actually, that won first place in its category at the World Tea Championship.
That's an
iced tea that we just launched last summer, and that one's been doing really well. It has a really bright red infusion because of the hibiscus in the blend.
Yeah, we stationed ourselves right in front of the picture and kept refilling our glass.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Oh, was it in New York?
Yes,
at the fancy food
show.
Oh,
I was probably serving you the tea.
You probably were, and we didn't even know it. Funnily enough, we had hibiscus iced tea because it was the house non-alcoholic drink at a restaurant called
Town
in New York City. And hibiscus iced tea is also very popular in Australia, where they, of course, grow a lot of hibiscus anyway.
Sure.
But it's such a dramatic color. But here's a question. You now have 150 types of tea. Mm-hmm. But to begin with, you presumably only had one. Anne was asking me the other day, he said, I wonder how they find a new tea. Can you tell us about that?
Sure thing. Well, Joshua spends most of his time in Asia. And through working direct with the farmers and with the producers of these teas, he's able to have a really personal relationship when it comes to sourcing these teas. So finding a new tea can mean anything from him just tasting something that he really enjoyed, or him and our blender coming up with amazing blends here in Milwaukee. But it's through that direct contact that we're able to taste these amazing teas pretty much as soon as they're picked, as soon as they're harvested, and as soon as they're processed.
Yeah, because you sort of have to wait. You can't just pick them. You have to wait for them to dry, right, to figure out whether they're really going to be any good.
Yeah, exactly. And he has an amazing talent where he can, you know, without even taste, he can look at these. He can look at the area, he can look at the plant, he can look at how they're processing it, and he just has this intuition when it comes to leaves. So it's quite an amazing talent that he has, and of course he's been doing it for quite a number of years, but it's very nice to be able to hear him talk.
Oh, I'll bet, yeah.
Origin.
Now, have you been out there?
I haven't, no, not yet.
Oh,
not
my
yet.
Goodness. I can't believe that you're in charge of marketing and you haven't been. We better pass that message on to Jonathan.
I know, yeah. Well, he does. I do spend a lot of time with Joshua, and he gives me a lot of crop reports. I get to cup teas with him because I'm the person that sells to the direct consumer. So it's very important for me to know how every tea tastes and, you know, what people might like about it and what they might not like about it. So I'm very lucky to work very closely with him and gain that knowledge from him.
Now, why do you, I mean, everybody has an explanation. Why is it that all of a sudden, tea has been probably the most widely consumed beverage since antiquity, but why is there this huge interest in more exotic brands of tea now? And you know, it's just taking over and expanding.
Sure. I think there's a couple of things that are working together for this. I think people have always been connoisseurs of beverages. People have been drinking wine and understanding them for years. And I think now people are starting to understand that teas are very similar to wine. It's all one plant, different varietals, different origin, different processing standards. And once people are starting to gain this knowledge, and they're starting to feel a lot more comfortable because they already know half of the vocabulary. They know how to taste wine. They know how to taste all of these other cheeses and things like that. So I think it's a natural progression. People are just, they're becoming exposed to it, and he has definitely been in the news a lot more often, has had a lot more press here. So we're definitely late at catching on to what the rest of the world has already known, but I think it's definitely coming on strong. And not only that, but I think people are really interested in the health benefits of it.
Yeah, I was just going to say that's probably a strong motivator, the health
issue. Yeah, definitely. I mean, we can see, I see it on the website. There was a story on matcha done not too long ago, and immediately that weekend we received a lot of visits because of matcha itself. So the press is definitely helping out with all of the reports that it's coming out with.
Now, Rishi tea is readily available in supermarket-type distribution?
You can find us at all the Whole Foods. You can find us at coffee shops, at natural health food stores, co-ops, and you can also buy directly from our website, and we can ship directly.
Of course, figuring out which one you want is always...
Yeah, that's always...
I mean, I like that silver needle stuff.
That's always a challenge. I have an off-the-wall question for you. You talked about wine just a second ago, and
yes.
I guess in a way you could compare tea with coffee in a certain respect, in that they're both tropical crops. Coffee's made into a liqueur. In fact, it's used in several, including a coffee bean floating in Zambuca, but I've never heard of an alcoholic beverage with tea.
Oh, there is.
Oh,
vodka.
There is one?
There's vodka with green tea.
Vodka with green tea, but that's sort of different.
I mean, well, you know, we actually did. We had a holiday party at the beginning of the year, and we did some infusions of ourselves, of our own. We took vodka and infused them with different teas, different botanical blends, and served those as mixed drinks. And it actually came out quite nice. We just put them in a glass pitcher, put the tea in there, filled it with vodka, and let it sit in the fridge for a while.
Yeah, when a competitor of yours sent us a whole bunch of tea infusion tea bags, the ones that have the little leaf coming out on one end.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know which one I mean. And they're meant
to...
Yeah,
we won't mention the brand.
No, but they're meant to infuse cocktails. And they really worked out well. We had a dinner party, and each of the infusion little packets was a different flavor. But we got a glass.
Yeah, we put them in sparkling. We made them with sparkling wine.
And we poured sparkling wine with these little sachets and a little leaf in the center in different flavors, and they all turned different colors. It was very smart.
Very nice.
Very smart.
Yeah.
Very trendy. They look very good too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, are we missing anything? Is there anything else you'd like to tell us about Rishi Tea?
Well, we're actually just launching this year. We're really excited about launching a gift set that's going to be called Taste of Origin. And it's actually, I think, more than a gift set. It's definitely a way to be able to tie people to where their tea comes from. We're concentrating on the Manong Manmai Fair Trade Association in Yunnan, China. And through these gift sets, we want to be able to transport people to that area when the tea is being harvested. We want to teach them about the culture there. And you touched on coffee a little bit, and I think coffee does that really well at tying the bean to the origin and really being able to give that message. And that's what we're really looking to do with tea, because I think it's going to definitely help people really understand a lot more than just what is in their cup. It's going to help them understand how exactly that leaf has made it into that cup and how it comes from these cultures and these traditions from abroad. So it's something we're really excited about. It's going to be launching mid-October, so it'll be ready for the holiday season.
Oh, well, I'm sure I'll get more information closer to the launch date.
Definitely.
Well, what a delight it was to talk to you and to find out about two young men from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, who are doing things with tea. Quite unlikely development, in my own opinion, even though you seem to think it was sort of an obvious thing to do.
Yeah, everybody's kind of amazed. It was really nice coming on and talking to you guys about the company.
Yeah, I might add one thing about the email or the website is that there is a hyphen between R-I-S-H-I, Rishi, and T.
Exactly.
Dot com.
Okay. Rishi-T, and wave to the Polish moon next time you go by.
We sure will. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of beverages today, huh?
We certainly have, and we actually closed the loop at the end, because you'd notice I asked Rishi about alcoholic beverages based on tea and discovered that, in fact, those exist. So I don't know if Dale DeGroff does tea-infused
things. Oh, that's part of this new cocktail movement.
So,
yeah,
so,
they do a lot of
cocktails
with a tea base and also with wine base.
Yeah, so we've really come full circle, and there is more to life than Long Island iced tea, and there's more to life than you ever knew in the wonderful world of tea from around the globe with Hani and Rishi. And, of course, what a delight it was to begin the program with Dale DeGroff, and I'm sure that he's going to be a guest.
Yeah, maybe
again.
If he's listening, he can email me and tell me whether or not they spit.
There you go. Well, I'll also be sure to make a point of when I let Dale know about the program that's going to be on the air, I'll try to remember to ask him that question as well, because I'm sure that inquiring minds like OTM listeners will want to know, just like Anne does. And in the meantime, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.